Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn. My usual sparring partner, Ann Thompson, is on her way back from the New York Film Festival to her home of Los Angeles. And we're sorry to miss her, but I have a wonderful replacement this week who has been on Screen Talk before and is very well equipped to fill in today. And that's my colleague, David Ehrlich, our chief film critic. And if you can't see David right now, if you're only listening to us, he is currently in Red Rocket Universe, based on his Zoom background, riding around with Simon Rex. So how are things down south?
Things are good. I'm trying to remember the name of his character in the movie to say that I am joined by Mikey Saber, of course.
How do you forget that?
a name chosen, for him, by him. Things are going very well. Thank you for having me back on. Anne leaves large shoes to fill, but I will do what I can after a couple months of weary festival going.
Yeah, weary festival going, but very productive festival going, because we went to Cannes, we went to Telluride. New York obviously is, for those of us with privilege enough to see these movies throughout the year, more of an opportunity to kind of come back to a lot of stuff and see how it's playing. But I think it is fascinating that you don't really know how something's going to land at New York Film Festival on the basis of how it played somewhere else. Like Red Rocket, for example, got shut out of Cannes. It seemed like it went pretty well at New York Film Festival. What's the vibe that you were getting from people who were catching up with that one this past week?
I mean, it seems effusively positive, and I think that's true of a number of movies that received anywhere from muted to politely enthusiastic responses at Cannes. I mean, there was excitement around Red Rocket, which I loved out of Cannes. I know that I wasn't alone, but there is often the inverse phenomenon happens at Cannes that does at every other festival, where I think, stereotypically, there are movies that premiere at a place like Sundance that everyone goes bananas for. And then when they open on C-level, the response is a bit more mixed. I think at Cannes, I will never forget as long as I live, the year that Certified Copy played there, because while it won the Best Actress Prize for Juliette Binoche, the response was mixed. And then I saw it at the press screening at the New York Film Festival and was like, this is clearly one of the greatest films I've ever seen in my entire life. And it felt like I was not alone in thinking that. So that can happen with Cannes stuff. Red Rocket, had some heat coming off it from Cannes, but there was definitely, just from what I could gather over the internet this past week, a lot more enthusiasm for it. I think the same is even more inevitably true for an audience-pleasing film like The Worst Person in the World. The French Dispatch seemed to get a warmer response here than it did.
Much warmer. In fact, French Dispatch is a fascinating example of a movie that could probably have just launched at New York Film Festival, if you think about it. I mean, Cannes seemed to have bragging rights on that one for the better part of a year, and they probably needed the red carpet appearance of various people who came out for that movie. In fact, they needed it so badly, they let them skip the press conference. But if you really think about it, I mean, the response at Cannes was kind of mixed. Didn't seem to blow people away at Telluride, but New York seemed like they were much more sort of there for the kind of the Wes Anderson anthology project that they could embrace as cinephiles who want to, champion a guy like that.
So yeah, I mean, it's like that movie, do you want to honor in terms of its festival birth, the French part or the New Yorker bedrock of those stories? And it may have fared better here, although I think a contingent of the audience, after they had that like top layer of expectation peeled back and a better understanding of what the movie's strengths would be, and where it might fall short and like not having as strong of an emotional through line, let's say, as something like the Grand Budapest Hotel, they could engage with it on different levels. But I think even people who weren't so tapped into the minute by minute waves of response to that movie seemed to enjoy it more out of New York. So,
and another thing that's fascinating about New York is that you can get curatorial context for films that can be totally different from the way they launched. And Hamaguchi's films that are at the festival this year are a great example, because he had Wheel of Fortune Fantasy in Berlin, right? And then Drive My Car was at Cannes. Drive My Car was sort of the quote unquote bigger movie, and it won a prize at Cannes. It was well reviewed, but it's a talky 3-hour movie that doesn't necessarily break out of the pack when you have some much showier, snazzier filmmaking like Titan or whatever. So it was interesting to have him come to New York Film Festival with two movies that seemed like they really elevated his profile among English language cinephiles. I mean, I was just seeing a lot of enthusiasm, not just about one movie or the other movie, but about him as a talent. And I know you're a big fan, right?
Yeah, and as you're saying, I mean, the New York Film Festival gives a great opportunity to put these things in a different context than some of these movies had when they initially premiered. And you can really feel, you know, especially when it comes to movies as talky as Hamaguchi's, them speaking to each other, and the way that these projects overlapped in terms of their genesis, and eventually, because of COVID, their production, it makes that even more lucid. And a really, you know, this is someone who already had a large fan base, and despite the length of his movies and how chatty they are, was becoming increasingly popular on the world stage, maybe second among current Japanese filmmakers only to Hirokazu Koreeda. So but to hear those movies speak to each other, it does really give a sense of who he is as an artist, what his preoccupying themes are, and just to appreciate the differences. I mean, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy is wonderful. It is a scrappier, cheaper DIY effort that was totally done on his own terms. Drive My Car is a more austere, longer Murakami adaptation, which comes with its own baggage, with more money behind it, and is the shoo-in for Japan's pick at the Oscars this year. They're both excellent, and they both show different sides of a filmmaker who has some very obviously recurring preoccupations.
And we'll see, presumably Drive My Car is a front runner to be the Japanese Oscar submission. It'll be fascinating to see what happens there. Some sort of new production or distribution company called Side Door, we don't know a lot of details about it, is releasing it in tandem with Janus Films. So if it is the Japanese submission, that could be a good thing for him on some level. But again, you know, it's a different kind of movie. So it'll be.
The Janus element guarantees that it's going to be put out on the Criterion Collection probably in 2022, which assures a certain kind of destiny for the film beyond even the Oscars. And you know, it's a big milestone for Hamaguchi. So it's really exciting to see those movies together. I do think it's probably the prohibitive favorite for Japan's pick, and I wish we lived in a world where it would get the screenplay attention, and like it was sort of a automatic pick for best screenplay at Cannes. It's probably unlikely, but depending on what happens with France, it could vie for the award itself.
A really good point. I think also that it's worth looking at how important that conversation is for so many movies, because the process through which movies get submitted for international contention is so narrow and exclusionary, because each country gets one pick. Sometimes they have their own political reasons for not picking movies, and that shouldn't be the end of the conversation. I mean, we'll see what happens with the French submissions, right? We've got Titane, we've got Happening, which won Venice, and Celine Sciamma's film Petite Maman. So if Titane doesn't get it, it's going to be harder to campaign for that movie in some bigger categories, but I'd be all about, you know, a Vincent Lindon supporting actor campaign or screenplay or something. It's just about getting people to think outside of those narrow parameters.
I mean, between this and Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Celine Sciamma has sort of become the poster child for, you know, brilliant filmmakers getting screwed by this exclusionary rule. Again, you have a movie that could have been a big part of the fall conversation and dotted a lot of year-end lists with Petite Maman, but now, because Neon understandably doesn't have faith that Neon also has Titan in their quiver, but like they don't have faith that is going to be the submission for France. It's going to come out in 2022, and I think lose a little bit of momentum, even if it opens into a less cluttered landscape. So it's a tough break, but who knows what's going to happen with France? I mean, they screwed Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and they they felt the blowback for it. And this year they have a bigger, more interesting brain trust picking that award, or that nomination rather. But there is a lot of competition. Do you go with the Palme d'Or winner, which would ordinarily seem like an automatic call, but Titane is one of the films that has been cooler received in New York. I mean, I think with the hype of anything that was inevitable. And
also, it's a divisive movie. Yeah. I mean, think about showing that movie to the worst stereotype of older Academy voter with conservative sensibilities.
Yeah, I mean,
not an obvious.
Not at all. And now you have Happening, which I haven't seen, but is supposedly wonderful and won Venice and seems like a more traditional contender in this kind of competition. So it really, that will be an interesting story to follow.
Yeah, there were a couple of snubs this week for international. I know if Anne were here, she'd want to talk about this because it's such a steady stream of updates that you get. In some cases, you're like, what is that movie? We didn't know this country even had something contention or whatever. And then suddenly it gets nominated. So there'll be some surprises. You can't take anything for granted, especially with the shortlist. And, you know, there's so many different variables in play. But it was notable, I think, that Nadav Lapid, who had this film Ahed's Knee, was very a film that is very critical of the Israeli military, was not the submission. It was Aaron Kaliran's film, the other Israeli film that was at Cannes this past year that got a decent reception, but also has some controversy behind it because it's actually a film that is based on a Palestinian novel. So the question is it really an Israeli film? You know, there's going to be conversations about
it. I mean,
that.
Taking that other film out of the equation for a moment, I think Nadav Lapid probably would have felt as if he'd failed with Ahed's Knee had Israel chosen it to represent the country here.
But it's cinema. Yeah. I mean, I think that what happens though a lot of times is that the only way to kind of get past that is to be so revered that the country can't ignore you.
Right.
You know, if that movie won the Palme d'Or and it was probably not ever really in serious contention.
Although Ahed's Knee is such a funny example because it's literally about the institutions in Israel that police what art is acceptable and like gets into the nitty gritty of the offices that are controlling that. So it's a really sticky wicket. And I think it's sharp enough and so, you know, spitting angry like, you know, so many of his movies are that, you know, I don't think Israel would have ever seriously entertained the idea of picking.
Right. And then meanwhile, you have Pedro Almodovar, who you would think with Parallel Mothers, the closing night of New York Film Festival, that should be an obvious submission for Spain. Instead, they went with this comedy film, the other movie that has Penelope Cruz in it this fall, Official Competition, maybe because Pedro is just too famous for them or too obvious, or maybe because he's made a movie that actually deals explicitly with the Spanish Civil War and they don't like talking about that. So something happened.
Like they didn't, I could be wrong, but I feel like they did not submit Official Competition. They went with a movie called The Good Boss.
Oh, thank you for correcting.
Which stars Javier Bardem, so another member of the Penelope Cruz household.
Yes.
But
I'm glad you caught that because the thing is Official Competition is the other kind of, you know, higher profile Spanish language movie that was going around this fall. So I've had it on my mind. Sure. This is something that I wasn't tracking at all. And I don't think any of us really were.
I mean, it's been, I know Guy Lodge from Variety had reviewed it at some festival, but it didn't play as far as I know at any of the ones that we attended.
Right. But Javier Bardem, you know, maybe more appealing, the subject matter is more tangible or something like that. Who knows? But these kinds of updates, I mean, it really shows you that unless you pay attention to the minutia of this process, it's really easy to kind of dismiss the Oscars as being out of touch or whatever. But the way the system is set up, they're actually at the mercy of all these countries in a way that forces them to be very negative.
A lot of damage has been done by their laws by the time the committees, the Oscar committee itself actually gets together to shortlist. So
I mean, I've talked to Academy voters who are basically like, you know, the most engaged I can be is waiting for the shortlist and then trying to watch everything on the shortlist. That's where I feel like I can do my best work. And of course, the challenge there is like, well, then you're still at the mercy of other, you know, other people and other forces. So it's always interesting to kind of imagine, well, what would you do in that situation? Because we watch movies all year round. So if we could make those shortlists, they would always look very different. And I guess we do make our own shortlists in a way.
When they had the save system, I don't know if they're bringing that back. I remember Anne saying something about them eliminating it, maybe, but where there was some body that could choose to, you know, save a movie that was not going to make the short list, just on the merits of its quality. But
yeah, you can put they can push something in last minute, but you know, that's still, it's pretty whimsical in terms of how that goes down. Yeah. So let's step away from New York Film Festival for a minute, unless you want to talk about Dune a little bit more and how you decided to rewatch it and reconsider your opinion or something.
Somehow I haven't found the time.
You know, fascinating. Neither of us were fans of that movie. I mean, you obviously had the ultimate takedown. You had the most extreme reaction, but I think it is funny to me that Dune was at New York Film Festival and seems to have gone over well enough that nobody's really questioning it, because it's hard. It's really hard to see how that movie gels with the rest of the lineup this year.
I mean, yeah, or you know, with the rest of the world.
Well, there's that too. That's all marketing, also.
Yeah, as people see it, I'm really curious. What, I mean, obviously the movie's been out abroad, but as more of the people that we know here see it, it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is. I mean, I don't want to get too much into presuming why or why not people do or do not like certain things, but I can say that, like, you know, there is a wealth of artistry that goes into the making of that movie. There is certainly, you know, from my end, a real desire to want to champion such tactile blockbuster filmmaking in this plastic age we live in. And whatever the movie's faults, I mean, the sense of scale and the weight of the world that Denis Villeneuve creates, it's undeniable. It's the kind of movie that, you know, if only it offered me anything else, I would have loved to have rallied behind. And I am very unsurprised that there have been plenty of people who have jived with the rest of it and had, you know, wanted to champion it. But I think that, like, you know, there are all sorts of cynical reasons you can describe to why a movie like Dune is playing at New York Film Festival in that rarefied air. But film is a wide medium, and I think that to ignore the artistic expertise, the craft that's on display in that movie. It's far from the most egregious thing that's ever played in the main slate of that festival. And even if it's, I'm not even sure if it's in the main slate this year, but I think it's probably maybe just like a one-off screening. But I think that there are cinematic elements there that are worth taking seriously and respecting, even if the movie as a whole didn't work for me.
I think I liked it more than The Walk, to be honest with you.
Well, yeah. I mean,
there weren't any terrible Joseph Gordon-Levitt accents and that kind of thing.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt doesn't even show up at all in Dune.
And I kept waiting.
You know,
everyone's in that movie, so.
Dune is certainly a lot longer than The Walk. Had Villeneuve been able to compress that story or the portion of it that he like arbitrarily tells in Dune Part One into the span of Philippe Petit's Wire Walk, I would have been really impressed. But
so that movie's coming out in a couple of weeks, but this week we've got James Bond. Anne and I talked about it a bit when we did our live event last week, and mostly we were just sort of dwelling on the weirdness of kind of cutting between New York Film Festival to go see Bond and sort of living in these two worlds, and like coming out of the Bond movie and getting news of a new Sundance CEO, and just like thinking about the different scales of things happening in the film community all at once. But I think it's worth talking just about what this movie represents in terms of blockbuster filmmaking right now, when we haven't had like a lot of slam dunk big screen kind of releases. Even if, you know, box office is doing okay, I think it's worth looking at, you know, why does James Bond belong on the big screen? Because there is an ongoing conversation now about, you know, people have spent the past year adapting to at home viewing, and James Bond is not a movie that provides that. No Time to Die is not a movie that provides that luxury. You know, you have to go see it in theaters. Eventually, some people will say they're going to wait. But in your estimation, why is this a big screen movie?
I mean, it's a loaded question, especially, you know, given this movie's place in the Bond canon and even just in the arc of the Daniel Craig movies. But, you know, we were lucky enough to see this movie on IMAX, in which it was partially shot for IMAX. And that's certainly, you know, the other extreme as opposed to watching something on your phone or television. And there was a real collective sense of giving yourself over to everything the movie was doing and to really sort of orienting your place in regards to where blockbusters are these days, sitting in that theater with other people. I mean, and that's kind of what the movie is about. And all this entire run of James Bond films have been questioning, you know, to an increasingly greater extent with every subsequent movie, the role, the need for a James Bond type, both as a archetype and also as a cultural figure, you know, the subject of blockbuster movies in an increasingly Marvelized world. And it's been so interesting to see how the Daniel Craig movies have made a big concession to the serialized storytelling that's so in vogue with franchise filmmaking right now, and making actual Bond sequels for the first time. And you cannot really get much out of No Time to Die if you have not seen and remember, when this is the really hard part, remembering what happened in Spectre.
I know. And as soon as they mentioned the word Spectre, I was like, oh, shoot, should I have gone back to that one? Because I felt a bit adrift in plot for a while there.
Yeah, and I think that No Time to Die doesn't really deliver the goods as a James Bond movie, but it is a satisfying conclusion to these five James Bond movies, and for what it gives to the, I mean, to the discourse, God forbid, of what James Bond represents as both a white man spy who works for the CIA and has a license to kill, and also as a physical human size, if not sort of immortal, counterpoint to the Marvel superheroes. I mean, he is kind of a superhero of his own now, but with one foot in the real world. But like, yeah, I mean, that's what this movie is about. And I think what's really going to be interesting is what they do next.
Yeah, you know, one thing I will say also just about the big screen thing that's fascinating is that it really does, it is a big screen movie. To me, it's a big screen movie for reasons you're not prepared for, in the sense that seeing Daniel Craig in extreme close-up on an IMAX screen is almost like a spectacle unto itself, right? I mean, it's like they're using his movie stardom to say something emotional about this character in a way that I thought was fascinating. I mean, the best things about the movie, as you've explained, are sort of the interiority of the guy, the challenges that he's faced, constantly putting his life at risk to the point where he literally has no time to die. Right. It's like there's a point in early in the movie where it's like he's like basically about to get killed, it seems. And he's sort of giving up. He's like, do I really need to do this again? And then finally we get all the spectacle stuff. It almost seems like a repudiation of all of that, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah. And just like, again, to the big screen of it all. I mean, there's a moment at the end of the unusually long Bond prologue in this movie, which ends on a note that I think feels more familiar to like a Richard Linklater before movie than it does a typical James Bond movie. But seeing that 16 stories tall or 8 stories tall, however big the IMAX screen in the upper
the real parameters,
with an audience on that scale, it melds the emotional sort of limpidness of what's happening in that moment about this like one guy and the girl that he can't bring himself to be with, with the blockbuster scale of what you're seeing. And it gives a very different flavor than it would watching a blockbuster on TV, where to your mind's eye, you could just be watching before midnight, before whatever, you know, before Bond, whatever this movie would be called.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, maybe that's the next direction when the Broccolis finally agree to have some spinoffs. You can have some sort of, you know, the more intimate Bond stories, you can do the Loki version or whatever on Q or one of these characters.
Stay away, Disney Plus. Not interested.
Well, I talked to Cary Fukunaga this past week, and he was saying, you know, they passed on everything, including Lego Bond, and that he was giving them credit for that. But he was also like, I kind of want to see Lego Bond. You know,
I mean, Lego Bond is the exception to the rule, because I mean, just on the strength of Lego Batman, which is a brilliant movie, Lego Bond would be hilarious and also not really dilute the Bond brand, the mainline brand. It wouldn't make Bond 26 any less of an event than it should be. Right. So
think about it, Broccolis. It's a brave new world for IP. So let's talk about one other big screen experience, and that is Memoria, which is a world apart from Bond many times over. I know you haven't seen the movie yet, right?
Not yet.
So I will try not to reveal too much about it, but I do think that it's worth talking about the discourse surrounding Memoria, which is something I never thought I would say for an Impeachment Weir debacle film. But Neon did something fascinating this week, which in a story that we broke, they made this decision to basically do like a traveling road show with the film that will go on indefinitely, 1 week at a time. So not a traditional platform release, really one city at a time, and never come out on VOD or anything. So you kind of have to see this movie in theaters. Now, I think the distributor probably expected this to be sort of like a, ooh, cool, they're doing something really different with this one, and was blindsided by the fact that now people really feel like they have a right to have options. And so the idea that you can't just dial up this movie, that you have to, you know, potentially risk your health to go into a movie theater and potentially might not live near a movie theater showing this movie was a bad thing. And so there was actually significant backlash. And A.O. Scott even ended up writing a piece like right away that went up by the end of the day in response to all of this. So where did you fall on this? I mean, you haven't seen the movie yet. So.
No, but... You know, it's funny. Where was the Twitter blowback against like Christian Markley deciding that the clock was only going to play for finite periods of time at museums across the country, even though, you know, once you are fortunate enough to see an hour of it, you feel like you're missing out on not seeing the other 23. I mean, like this, it's all about context with these things. If Neon weren't the distributor, if Tilda Swinton maybe weren't in it, it would be, this conversation would be, I would imagine, had by a different contingent of people and with different terms. Yeah. I do, you know, in broad strokes, agree with just about everything A.O. Scott said in the Times about the entitlement that you were speaking to. I think there's also something that film programmer Nellie Killian was raising on Twitter this week, is how these conversations obscure the compensation that is afforded the artists who make them, and how the everything all the time, I should be able to go on Netflix and stream everything. I mean, not only is it the A.O. Scott, what he was talking about like how when a movie is everywhere, it's kind of nowhere because it just goes into the morass of content and people don't watch it. But also, you know, just like concert musicians make, or you know, recording artists make the vast majority of their money these days from concerts, filmmakers are not being paid for, you know, when the movie comes on Netflix and they get pennies for fractions of a penny for 1,000 streams. So, I mean, I think that there are a lot of issues to take into account here, but at the end of the day, you have an artist who I assume that Weir Sathakul was very involved in this decision.
And now has to answer for it doing press. I think you hit on some really good points. And I would also add that, you know, this is a guy who works in a very limited kind of way as a creative person that affects the way he makes a living. I mean, it's one thing to say like, oh, somebody is owed more money than they're actually getting once this thing goes out into the digital marketplace, but they, you know, have an agent with all these different kinds of opportunities coming their way. This is a guy, he once told me in an interview that he was thinking of quitting the Academy because he didn't want to pay dues every year, which is like a couple $100 or whatever. And he's made a movie that has more in common with installation art. I think it's beautiful. It's a Colombian Oscar entry and Tilda Swinton is fascinating in it. But that's still from the film behind me. There's a scene where she's looking out at that empty thing and then she leaves and then you're looking out at it for a while. And the movie is filled with these moments like that and filled with silence and so forth, where you just kind of live in this world. It was shot in Bogota, which is a city because of half my family's from there that I was very familiar with. And I thought it was very attuned to kind of the mysterious nature in which it's both cosmopolitan and kind of ancient at the same time. But Apichapong's work has often been displayed in exclusive environments. He did a thing for New Museum called Primitive that traveled around a few other places. I didn't hear anybody complaining about that thing. You know, the Markley example is great. I mean, when there's a great Frank Stella exhibit at the Whitney, is anyone demanding that they deliver those sculptures to your doorstep? I mean, it's just a different context for art.
Yeah, and obviously this conversation is so much bigger than this one film. But again, it is one film at a time when every other movie is, if not immediately available, then available 3, 6, God forbid, 8 weeks later. And so the idea of, you know, ruffling feathers or, you know, what's the expression that I'm searching for at the end of this long week of...
Sounded right.
yeah, whatever, is over one special thing that exists in our world. You know, this beautiful idea that who knows if it actually exists in perpetuity or if they plan on caving in eventually and releasing it on physical media of some kind or streaming. I don't know. But the idea that we have this little ember of something special in the world that at any given time, Tilda Swinton is, on an ox cart driving reels of this movie around the country by hand. I mean, like that's a world I want to live in. I think it makes our world a more interesting place.
Now, if they had made this announcement about Dune, it would have been a very different story. Yeah. But
it won't be able to go to every small town in the country, but no. Those small towns probably don't have theaters already. It will go to the places that do. It will do a world of good for those local theaters. It will help them stay in business. I mean, it will do its own tiny share to stem the bleeding. I mean, this all sounds like good news to me.
Good. I'm glad we found an optimistic note to end on in these strange times, but there's much more to come. And next week I'll be back with Anne, but at some point, David, we got to bring you back before the end of the year, because you got your work cut out for you, man. A lot of more stuff to come around the corner from PTA to West Side Story. So Godspeed, and sure thanks is. Again for being here.
My pleasure.